Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How accurate is your view of the world? While it's common to move through the world assuming that what we see is what we get, it turns out that even the smartest of human beings have an astonishingly tenuous grasp on reality in the past, present, and future. In general, we are at risk for eating too much, spending and saving unwisely, and falling in love for all or at least many of the wrong reasons. Still, we've invented technology to keep us safe, warm, healthy, and well-fed, and we've created great art, literature, and cultures to set standards for decent behavior and consequences for violations. All in all, we have done pretty well for ourselves as a species. So how do you reconcile our successes with our constant and seemingly inevitable mistakes? Writer and documentary filmmaker Michael Kaplan wondered that as well. He explores the subject in his new book, co-written with Ellen Kaplan, who happens to be his mother. It is called Bozo Sapiens, Why to Err is Human. Michael, welcome to Think.
Thanks very much, Chris.
You say the most common errors are in perception. What do we tend to misunderstand?
Well, I think the idea primarily is that we're seeing an edited version of reality. Our brains, although they have an amazing number of connections within them, are very, very slow at processing. So the most important task within the skull is to edit, to cut things down so that you can make some sense of what you see before it gets on top of you.
So we need those shortcuts in order to avoid being overwhelmed.
Exactly. It's the sort of thing that you see all the time in, say, optical illusions, that we're building a version of what we see which will make some sense so that we can get on with it.
Now, throughout human history, we have struggled with this idea that, in fact, we don't see things exactly as they are, and with this, the concept of fallacious thinking. One of the things, for example, that Aristotle tried to get a handle on was this. Can you talk about what he discovered?
Well, before Aristotle, the real question was, how could you figure out whether something made any sense or not? And his idea was to put things very much into order so that instead of saying, I'm looking at your argument all in all and it seems to make sense or I have my doubts about it, let's try and systematize it into a system of basically nouns and adjectives. If you say all X are Y, you know, all humans are mortal, and then you say Socrates is human, then at least I can get to the conclusion that Socrates is mortal. I can understand that the things that you're saying are consistent with each other. And this is a great step forward, because before then, all you could really do is throw mud at each other.
How does our need, though, Michael, to find meaning in the world, whether it's religious or philosophical or even scientific, tend to lead us astray?
Well, I think there are a whole variety of things that happen. The first is, what Aristotle gave us was a way of judging whether what we're saying is consistent with what we said before. He didn't give us a way of being certain that what we said before was true about the world. Mm-hmm. It was just something where at least you could say it made sense with what we'd said. So until Francis Bacon's time, you know, so that's right at the end of the 16th century, we had no real method for taking the evidence of our senses and testing it, taking things and putting them to an experiment, which is the word that he invented. Up until then, pretty much all we could do is to say, is this consistent with a sacred text, or is this consistent with a decision of a group of people? We could do law, but we couldn't do science, and there's a really significant difference between them.
Did Bacon recognize the value in mistakes?
Yes, in some ways, because the essential thing that you're doing with science is you need to put your conclusions up to the test. You need to try and prove yourself wrong. If you don't try to prove yourself wrong, you're not making a scientific statement. So really, all we can say about science now is that these are things we've tried to prove wrong as hard as we can, and so far failed.
What are cognitive illusions?
They're the kind of things where you neaten the world, your vision of the world. So, for instance, most people, if they were to imagine a map of the world, they'd say, okay, New York, London, Moscow, all roughly about as far north as each other, whereas in fact New York is about level with nice warm places like Rome. We assume that Italy runs straight up and down, or we assume that, in fact, people have been tested and willing to bet good money that the potato was discovered in Ireland, or that more Americans die by homicide than by suicide. So generally, there are ways in which we take concepts and simplify them for our use, and never examine them again.
And we do that, I guess, because we hear about homicides in the news and not about suicides, but we don't start to think back to the people that we know who have died and put those numbers back together in a more rational way.
Exactly. And I think it also has to do with the use we're going to make of the information that we have, that homicide is a threat. It's a source of anxiety. It's something you might think you'd do something about to make yourself safe. So it tends to loom larger in your imagination than something which, effectively, you can't do anything about.
You talk about the idea that people are willing to bet good money on these things that are not true. How do cognitive illusions influence the degree of belief that we place in our own assessments of the world?
It works very straightforwardly, which is the less you know about something, the more certain you are. Take anything that you really know about. You know, if you were to be a bread maker and have a fantastic bread recipe, you'd say, if someone came up to you and said, oh, it's simple, you just mix flour and water and a little yeast, and there you are, you've got bread, put it in the oven. You'd say, well, it's never that simple. It doesn't work that way. You'd have all sorts of nuanced knowledge that goes into what you really know, and you'd express yourself in terms of, well, sometimes like this, and most of the time like that, and it depends, and all those kinds of probabilistic statements that, if you didn't know anything about it, you not bother with it. You just say, problem solved. I know how it works.
You write that we reason differently when we reason collectively. Can you talk about how the two situations are different?
Well, we are, like it or not, primates. And primates spend most of their time reasoning collectively to the degree that any monkey band has got to make a decision about where to go eat next or who's going to be breeding with whom and so on. What tends to happen, therefore, is that we look at the dynamics of a group as part of the evidence for a decision. So if you have, for instance, a point of view being proposed by someone who's got a great deal of dominance in this group, then the likelihood is that other people are going to see a lot of reason in that proposition, which they may not have seen if it was proposed by someone who didn't have the same dominance. If you see the extreme form of it was in the Solomon Ash experiments, where people were collectively deciding, this seems like a really silly thing, how long a line was compared to two other lines, whether it was the same length or longer. And the experimental subjects were part of a group making the decision, not realizing that the other people in the group were actually the graduate students of Solomon Ash. And they were willing to let themselves be persuaded that a line that was definitely longer than the other two was exactly the same length, simply because the dynamics of the situation made it seem necessary to agree.
How do we decide? It's pretty obvious how we decide who gets power within a society, but how do we decide within a small group who's dominant and who's the leader and who's the follower?
Well, it tends to have to do with self-belief. That's part of it. It's also the opinions of others. And then there are the various forms of physical cues and clues which say so-and-so is healthy, so-and-so is well-grown, or, now this is an interesting thing we have in common with the monkeys, so-and-so is literally well-groomed. If you look at a group of chimpanzees, one way in which dominance is established is by grooming relationships, riffling through each other's fur, getting the insects out. The more grooming services that someone can command, the better groomed that chimpanzee is going to look. And even now, humans are very keen on the appearance of lustrous, well-groomed heads of hair, which probably explains why the hair care industry is quite as large as it is.
So essentially, if you've got gorgeous hair, it tells everyone else that you've got the money and the health and the resources to look that way.
Yes, somebody has been taking care of you. And you are able to ask for people to take care of you, even if it's just your hairdresser.
Michael, are we less likely to repeat mistakes that we have made as individuals as compared with mistakes we make as societies?
I wish I could say so. I think the problem is that there are many mistakes that we fall into. Romantic mistakes, I suppose, would be the ones that people comes most quickly to mind. We fall into mistakes which become habitual, because in some ways we have lost the ability to imagine not making them. So societies do make mistakes, but in some ways the whole reason we have societies is to attempt to iron out the mistakes we make as individuals. Individuals' mistakes are much harder to break, especially once you get into a pattern of response which leads you astray.
Well, obviously, we need to be part of a group or of a society in order to succeed well in most cases. It, you know, literally takes a village. How does all this relate to our ability to empathize with other people?
Well, empathy really starts in a very basic brain function. There is a section of the brain which contains what are called mirror neurons. And Vilayu Ramachandran has been writing about these. Effectively, when you see somebody else doing something, a part of your brain fires, which is the part that would also fire if you did it yourself, so that you begin to use the same pathways in your mind for action, for imagining action, for seeing action, and for imagining being someone else doing that. So our empathy is very deeply ingrained in the structure of our brains. The interesting thing is that we vary in the degree to which we are capable of expressing that empathy, and that seems, and again, the science is rather new, it seems to be related to the density of our network of mirror neurons. Men tend to have fewer than women, and people who have difficulties on the autistic spectrum seem also to have fewer.
Why would men need fewer mirror neurons?
My suspicion, if you're looking back at the way in which tasks were divided back in the early Pleistocene, is the requirement of being more single-minded. That if you were in a hunting situation before all of the technology that we've invented that makes hunting easier, an awful lot of what's involved there is running for a very, very long time after a wounded or sick animal. And no distraction, no thoughts of others, no imaginings can really be allowed to dissuade you from this long and extremely dull task. You need to have that single-minded persistence. Whereas, again, this is, you know, a stereotype, but probably an accurate one, the gathering life requires a great deal of communication, of observation, of imagination, and of shared capabilities. And so you could see why there would be less need for a well-developed empathic sense in men than in women.
And, you know, we like to think that we've come so far from the people we were in the early Pleistocene. But in fact, you have some great examples in the book of if you had all your relatives stretching back for thousands of years, they would, in some cases, fit into a steakhouse. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, we've, as far as can be told, we haven't really made significant genetic changes in ourselves in the last 70,000 years. You could say that is, as those humans of 70,000 years ago are about as modern as us. So if you were to take, you know, do the math, took every generation, mother by mother or father by father, back to 70,000 years ago, you would be 2,000 to 3,000 people. You could fit them into a function room. If you were to go back to, say, the time when we invented agriculture, domestication of animals, that would be about 400 couples, so that's about enough as a wedding. Everybody since the time of Socrates, Buddha, and Confucius, you can put in a steakhouse, and in the 800 years since Averroes, Maimonides, or St. Francis, you could fit all those people into McDonald's.
Michael Kaplan is my guest. His new book is called Bozo Sapiens, Why to Err is Human. We'll resume our conversation in a moment. We welcome you to join us by calling now 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible in part by SMU summer camp programs, helping kids create, design, and think in fun new ways in Plano and on the Dallas main campus. Details online at smu.edu/camp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Michael Kaplan. His new book is called Bozo Sapiens, Why to Err is Human. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Because we are such social creatures, Michael, one of the things that tends to trip us up is the fact that we use our observations of other people and their welfare to assess our own. Can you talk about that?
Yes, indeed, Chris. I think it's an interesting problem, especially now when we've come out of what was one of the most prosperous, or at least one of the most expansionist times in American history. We always gauge our well-being on the basis of what we see around us. It's called in behavioral economics reference dependence, which is if everybody else has got hardwood floors, if everyone else has got a bigger car, if everyone else has a larger salary, we have to have it too. Not necessarily because we have any use for it, but because that is the way in which we gauge our standing in the world and also our well-being. The same way also is that anything which is ours is, by its very nature of being ours, more valuable than something equivalent on the open market. Dan Ariely did a study of this for basketball tickets at Duke, which is people are given basketball tickets in a lottery, and he attempted to establish a market to find out what other people would pay for them and what the people who had them would be willing to take for them. He couldn't get a single one sold. Once it was mine, nobody can have it. The difference in accepted price and offered price was about $1,000. And then finally, we have what is called reflection, which is the difference between what comes in and what goes out. And money coming in is not particularly exciting. It just is what you expect. Any money that goes out, ooh, it hurts. It feels terrible. So the difference between, say, seeing an extra $100,000 in your retirement plan and having put a $100 bill in the jacket you sent off to the dry cleaners is enormous. It makes it very, very hard to gauge what money is for and when you have enough.
Yeah, you write that money is really kind of a poor tool for assessing the value of things. It's a poor substitute for actual value.
Well, it's the same with a lot of the stimuli we get in life, that money is used as a way of being able to stand in for all the good things that we really like. But actually, it becomes something that we pay far more attention to than we do to the good things that it could buy for us. It's a bit like salt, fat, or sugar is something where we're taking the stimulus to stand in for what we really want.
I was really fascinated to read, by the way, your example that we're not the only primates who do this. Can you talk about what happens if you offer a monkey a slice of cucumber, but you give another monkey a grape and sort of how they assess the value of those things?
Well, my advice to you is don't. You have brown capuchin monkeys who are perfectly willing to learn how to work for tokens. They don't find this at all surprising. They don't need any training. They say, right, I'll do a certain amount of work. You give me a token, I'll trade it in for something nice. Give them a cucumber, and they'll say, well, it's not wild exciting, but I'll accept it. But if you give one monkey a cucumber, give her neighbor a grape, she's going to heave the cucumber at you as quick as she can. It's always a matter of what the other ones have. And if you look at what's been happening recently in, say, bonuses for executives, you know, there is a whole subsection of the consulting industry which is allowing executives to find out what other executives get. And if other executives are getting grapes when you get cucumbers, you want your board to even up the score. Everybody feels entitled because you need to make certain that it's fair all the way across.
Which sort of explains why so many companies who are not in the bonus business try to keep salaries a secret.
Yes. And, of course, all that means is people spend far more time trying to find out what they are.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Michael Kaplan is my guest. His book is called Bozo Sapiens, Why to Err is Human. What criteria do we use to define ourselves as part of a group?
Well, it depends whether you're talking about being part of a group which has a task, where we definitely want to be able to define ourselves as being competent, as being essential, or whether defining ourselves as part of, like, a romantic couple, where we're thinking very much about the immediate attraction, how we can say we're fun-loving or outgoing or gorgeous or all the things that you know from the Lonely Hearts ads.
And once we have defined a group, why is it so hard? I'm talking about a societal group. Why is it so hard to accept people who don't belong?
Well, it would be nice to say that people were making decisions on some higher principles, but actually it comes down very much to what people eat. If you go down, Jonathan Haidt is the person who's done a lot of research in this. If you follow people down the path and you don't let them weasel out and you say, well, what is it about these people? Why do you dislike this group of people? Or why do you dislike this course of action? It comes down eventually to the fact that they feel, ugh. They have some visceral sensation which they are rationalizing through a large number of usually specious reasons. And if you look at the way things work in less developed societies, it has to do with what the most basic behaviors are. If they eat stuff we don't eat, then there is something wrong with them and we can't get on with them.
Yeah, you have a whole litany of things that, people in particular cultures say about the smell of other people.
Oh, the Chinese say that the Dutch smell like sour milk. The Japanese used to complain that Europeans smelled like cold meat. Korea is supposed to have a general smell of garlic because there's so much garlic in Korean cuisine, cumin in India. And there's a sort of, there's the cornmeal smell that some people have identified in West Africa. So, yes, if you're starting off there, it becomes harder and harder to bridge the gaps because the first thing you're noticing is not something that appeals to reason.
So you also have some interesting research in the book about unconscious prejudices that we form, people who do not consider themselves to have racial biases, for example, when you test them, although they would not want to have any of these biases. In fact, they do.
Yes, and it's a surprising thing that you can have people whom you test and in their written responses, their spoken responses, they have no racial bias. Indeed, they appear to be extremely open. But if, for instance, you ask them to match favorable words with a face of their own race or a face of a different race, and unfavorable words with a face of their own race or a face of a different race, they are quicker to match the unfavorable words with a different race and the favorable words with their own race than if they have to do the task in the other direction. They also show generally a greater startle response to faces of another race, and they also find it harder to distinguish individuals.
And this is even happening in places where individuals are exposed to those of many other different races.
Absolutely. It's happening all over America right now. The interesting thing is that for, say, response to faces of another race as individuals, by and large, African Americans are better at distinguishing the faces of white Americans as individuals than the other way around, which implies that the experience of living as a minority in a society makes you more observant of the other, whereas the majority tends to be more face blind when looking at a different race.
Is there some kind of evolutionary reason? Were we served 50,000 years ago by being frightened of people who didn't look like us?
I think we were served 50,000 years ago by being frightened by anybody we weren't related to.
Mm-hmm.
If you're living in a very limited society with limited horizons, as long as you have very little contact with everyone else, then the stranger can be welcomed because there's no competition for resources. But as people begin to bump into each other at the waterhole, at the fruit tree, where the animals congregate, suddenly there is a sense that if we don't have it, they might. And keeping them out is going to be important. There's even the theory that our sense of community, our sense of us, is something which developed as a response to realizing that they might get it, rather than the other way around.
So what do we do about these unconscious prejudices now that we live in an era where we're not, at least in the United States, competing around the waterhole for resources, where we recognize that this is not helping us?
Well, part of it is obviously any mistake that you make without thinking about it, you might make less if you did think about it. But on the other hand, we should realize that these are visceral things. And if you're going to deal with a visceral problem, you maybe need a visceral solution. We do. And one of the things about America that other countries tend to notice is our emphasis on soap and toothpaste and mouthwash and all the other things that render us a bit more acceptable to strangers. And in some ways, that may be explained because we are such a melting pot. We don't want people to say that we smell like cold meat or sour milk. And we make certain we smell of soap. It seems a better choice. The second is to realize that the ways in which we form a community include things like laughing together and dancing together and sharing the experience of motherhood or all the other things that cross every social group's boundaries. The more connections we make in these informal ways, in these basic ways, the more likely we are to see somebody else as being a person and not a member of a group.
You alluded to this earlier, but one of the areas in which many of us seem inclined to make disastrous choices is in the selection of a life partner. Let's start with this. What plays into our assessments of who is attractive as a partner?
It's breeding, really. And you're looking for the physically ideal mate. And there are all sorts of good reasons for coming up with the kinds of things that people do value and that they do say about themselves when they're describing themselves in the kind of would-like-to-meet ads that you see in newspapers or on the internet. Ultimately, we sort of forget now what a huge gamble breeding is for any animal and for humans in primitive societies, that generally, the male imperative is to want to produce as many children as possible, but to make certain that they are not somebody else's children. And the female imperative is to get the right male input and the right sort of protection for herself and the child. And a lot of what we're looking for in another, in a romantic partner, are the kinds of guarantees that that will be the case.
And all of our mouthwash and toothpaste and deodorant aside, one thing that used to play into our attraction to other people was our scent, and that seems to not be so much of an issue, at least in modern life.
Ooh, you might think so, but then there is the Swiss T-shirt test. Have you heard about this?
Yeah, I read it in the book.
Oh, good. Well, there is, in Switzerland, a place where people are also very fond of soap, a simple test took men to sleep in T-shirts for 2 nights. And then only the T-shirts were given to women to smell. And may not necessarily be the thing you'd want to do in a psychological study, but this was the study. And the results were fascinating, is that the women were most attracted to the scent of the man whose immune system was the most different from hers. So in some ways, she was looking for a complementary set of genes that would provide her offspring with a yet stronger resistance to disease. Now, they had no idea that this is what it was all about, but it certainly was a robust result.
So is there evidence, though, that since we can cover up all these odors now, and most of us go to heroic lengths to do so, that in fact this still plays a role in how we choose people?
Oh, I think so. It's anecdotal evidence, but I think there is a strong sense that the right smell from the right person is a guarantee of feeling at ease and comfortable for a much longer time, and that the wrong one is not something you're ever going to get over.
You also point out that life partnerships require balancing interests that are not identical. Are we simply unwilling to compromise, and do we sort of trip ourselves up there?
Well, if you look at what the task of partnership is, rather than what the, you know, perhaps the romantic novel idea is, we trip ourselves up in one basic way, which is that we are keeping our emphasis on romantic attraction for a very long time. We're attempting to live up to that first moment of being blown away through an entire lifetime, partly because we have less to do, less physically to do. Our tasks are not as absorbing, nor are they as differentiated as they used to be. So since we now have all the technology to do so many of the domestic things which were previously what we spent our days on, we're looking at our relationships through the lens of romance rather than the lens of history and mutual respect and admiration that a lifetime spent working together used to build up.
So we look to our partners to provide pleasure for us as opposed to sort of being half of a partnership.
Yeah, I think so. I think that that certainly is one of the ways in which we're likely to go off the rails, and it may have something to do with explaining why the divorce rate has doubled since 1960. There is, in some ways, we're still looking for the last page of the romantic novel to be repeated infinitely thereafter.
Yeah, the movies always stop with the happy moment when people get together. They don't show them 10 years down the line shopping for a microwave or whatever.
I'm not sure many people would go to see it.
Are there ways to sort of get over this romantic notion, do you think?
Well, I think one of the interesting things for this, and it's also something which is to do with the mistakes we make about money, is to realize that experience is what life is all about. It is not about objectifying what we get. There's a sense that you get your life partner, and then that life partner is to agree an object. It's a bit like an acquisition. You say, well, you know, over the years, he's beginning to deteriorate, and wasn't the thing that I bargained for to begin with. Same thing with the things you buy. Your car begins to clunk and bump. Your house begins to look a little dowdy. You start saying, the investment that I made, whether emotional or financial, is somehow leaching away. I've lost the pleasure in it. If you want to spend your money on something which will give you pleasure forever, you should spend it on an experience. You should go someplace. You should do something. You should go river rafting. You should go parachuting. In the same way with people, is that you need to make certain that you have the experiences which make that relationship valuable to you. That's what real worth is.
Michael Kaplan is my guest. His new book, co-written with Ellen Kaplan, is called Bozo Sapiens, Why to Err is Human. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible in part by SMU summer camp programs, helping kids create, design, and think in fun new ways in Plano and on the Dallas main campus. Details online at smu.edu/camp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Michael Kaplan, whose new book is called Bozo Sapiens, Why to Err is Human. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. You also have some really interesting information in the book, Michael, about why we make a big mistake in how much we think we need to eat. And once again, I guess we're still walking around in bodies designed for a vastly different reality.
That's absolutely true, Chris. And in some ways, the interesting thing is that we're still the slaves of the urges that we had when we were wandering the fringes of the savannah.
So we essentially, or our bodies were accustomed to eating a little bit every day and then occasionally having these enormous feasts.
Well, I think that our bodies were accustomed to wanting all the good things that the world had out there, but the things the world didn't provide, very many of them. The fascinating thing is that we think now of hunger as being a thing you definitely want to avoid. The one thing you don't want to feel is hungry. But if you look at the effect on our bodies of ghrelin, which is the hormone released by hunger, it makes us much sharper, much more aware of our surroundings, much more energetic, much more ready to go and get. So clearly, the assumption was that we were going to spend most of our time hungry because that's what actually set us out on the path to find our nourishment.
And yet, for most of us, the sensation of hunger is so unpleasant that we almost can't bear it for very long.
It's partly because we're not used to it. It's the same way that things like salt, things like fat, things like sugar, things like red meat, we want those things because they are good. We actually do need them. You need salt for good nerve function. You need sugar for energy. You need fat to build your brain, for one thing. and red meat is an excellent source of protein to make us stronger. The fact was that we want it so much because it was so hard to get. And now that we have it in front of us all the time, we can't switch off the light that says yes.
Of course, food has always, or it would seem has always, filled a social role as well as a physical one. Can you talk about how we use food to regulate emotion and to mark occasions?
Well, I think our response to good food, our response to all of the things that we desire, is a profound feeling of fulfillment, a profound feeling of having achieved what we were after, which, again, you could understand from a primitive environment, and it's something where we use it as the means to reaffirm our social ties. And this goes all the way back to primate life. Handing out good things to eat is a way of showing that we are all connected and that we all sympathize with each other. When you have something to celebrate, you should always have something to eat. You should invite friends over. You should have a birthday party, all those sorts of things. The important thing, though, is that this comes along with the social relations. It's not something which happens all by itself. And when we isolate food from all its social connotations, we get ourselves into the state of being effectively addicted to the stimulus rather than to the thing of value. So if you look, say, at the infuriating fact that the French eat far more fat than we do, they drink without reserve, they have all those wonderful pastries, and yet they don't put on weight. There's not an obesity problem in France to compare with what we have in America. The reason has to do with its social connotations, the way they eat, not what they eat.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Ben in Dallas. Hi, Ben.
Hi. How's it going?
Fine, thank you. Go ahead.
I have not called a radio show before, but this topic is very interesting to me. Anyway, my question was...
turn off your radio. Hey, Ben, flip off your radio, okay?
Yeah, I'm driving. Anyway, this subject has always interested me, and I gotta say, I'm on my way to the library right now to pick up the book. But my question has to do with humans in the population that we exist today, especially in urban societies. And I'm looking right now, and all I see is cars. I don't see a single person on the road or on anywhere. I can't see any humans. I mean, and everyone has their windows tinted and shades are all pulled down, yet there's about 20 million of us in the same about 10, 20, 30-mile radius. I mean, how does that affect us as a species?
Well, badly, Ben. I think that's the simple answer. We are attuned to handle a pretty small social group. There's this really neat thing, which is called the Dunbar number. Robin Dunbar has studied the social connections of social animals, ranging all the way up from things like prairie dogs up to humans. And he's found a correlation between the size of the cortex of the brain and the number of individuals that the given animal can recognize as individuals. And humans are at the top of the pyramid here, as we are so often. But the limit of the number of people that we can really think of as individuals is 150 people. And it's a very robust number. Any social grouping that you care to look at, and one example is, say, Christmas card lists. Most people have a Christmas card list, which isn't bigger than 150. 150 we can deal with, and we can think of them as having characters and needs and quirks and behaviors which are different from our own. But after that, it's just a mass of people, and we can't think of them individually, and that's one of the difficulties that we now run into in urban life.
It's interesting. I was reading that about the Christmas card list, and I thought you could probably do a similar study now with people's Facebook lists.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. 150, if it's more than 150, you know that this person isn't really friends with all of them.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Bill in Dallas. Hello, Bill.
Hello. I'd like to ask the speaker a question. That is, if he had the pleasure to sit across the table from Chris Boyd, would he believe that he is dealing with matter in motion only, or was there something there called spirit?
Well, Bill, I think there is something there called spirit, but it's something that in some ways we don't have the tools to distinguish from matter in motion. There is what we understand as spirit, but there's a lot of things that we understand in experience only because that's the way we are designed to understand them, not necessarily because we can say for certain that it's out there. As I said before, what we're so often doing in experience is trying to edit it. And in a way, the brain is the great artist making this experience comprehensible to us, manageable by us, but not necessarily reflecting what the experience out there really is.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Frisco and speak with Nell. Hey, Nell.
Hi.
Go ahead, please.
Sorry. He said something about taking the giving people a test, showing them pictures, and having them associate words with them. And I actually took that test online for that for my sociology class.
This is the picture of people of different races, Nell?
Yeah, or 3 years ago. And it was really interesting how I didn't consider myself racist. I'm from a town that's half white, half Hispanic, really tiny. And it said at the end of the test that I had a slight inclination towards those of Western European heritage. And I found that really interesting. And I also found it really interesting how it would pop up, how fast it was. It was really hard to disassociate yourself when it was a negative word, negative word, negative word, and then it would be a certain race, positive word. And it would just, like, it was really interesting to try to, like, associate it in your mind.
What did you do with that, Nell? Were you disturbed when you got that back, or did you think, well, maybe everyone else is the same way?
Well, it was weird because I didn't think of myself like that at all, but it kind of makes sense in a way when you think about how you were brought up, that you would associate something like that. But for the words, I was like, how am I supposed to associate them with a positive word when it keeps popping up a negative word?
So I think you're right, Nell. And the essential thing for the test was to make it so quick that you couldn't think about it. Because so often the kinds of basic conceptual errors that we fall into come from the brain's attempt to provide a quick answer. Because physically the brain is very slow. So it takes shortcuts if it wants to provide a quick answer. But you're right, if you thought about it, if you took some time about it, you probably wouldn't have come out with the same results.
You live in Edinburgh right now, is that correct?
That's right.
Yeah. Do you think that the results are different or would be different in a place where there are a lot more people who are very similar in terms of their genetic heritage and then a smaller group of immigrants starting to come in from faraway places who look very different?
I think the dynamics work interestingly, which is that Scotland is a place which has only Scots in it, but it means that, of course, Scots are able to tell the difference among each other in ways that nobody from outside could tell. So if Scotland were an independent country, it would quickly split into six smaller countries. When people come in, the first response is usually that this is, as I said, in a small community, the first strangers are always welcome. Because they bring news and they bring variety and there's something exciting about it. It's only as immigration moves up to the point where it starts having social implications and appears to be a matter of how well the goods in society are being distributed, things like jobs, things like housing and so on, that suddenly the whole welcoming attitude switches around. So, yes, it's a critical mass, I think, is what makes the difference.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Vivian in Denton. Hey, Vivian.
Hey, how you doing, Chris?
Great, thank you.
I was wondering if Michael would address, I heard that it's, besides a person's religion, food preference is the most difficult thing to get a person to change. And as a home health aide, I work with people whose health requires that they change their dietary preferences or whatever, but it's the most difficult thing I can get them to do is to change their diet.
You're absolutely right, Vivian, but if you want your children to be open-minded about new foods, you actually have to start them very, very early. It's something where before pretty much the age of three, you need to be little portions of something new and surprising, because otherwise their preferences are set, and for good reason, because in the jungle, there are things you can eat and things you can't. And you rely on your parents to let you know. I guess in this case, one of the things is that, you know, we are humans. The reason the book is called Bozo Sapiens is because, yes, we make the mistakes, but we also get, as a trade-off from these mistakes, our amazing capabilities. We can think about things in a way that other animals cannot, and we can respond to the challenge, to the discipline. But I think if you need to make a big change in your life, that has to be the most important thing you're doing in your life. You need to move everything around it, your schedule, your almost your self-image, to be able to manage that straightforward change in habit.
How do you think mistakes play into expertise in any particular subject area? And this sort of goes back to what you were saying about our creativity and our adaptability.
Well, if you are really interested in something, then even your mistakes in it are interesting. An example I think of is, you know, Tiger Woods, the golfer. That, you know, if his drive has gone all to pieces, that's not something where he's going to be spending all day pounding his forehead and saying, why do I do this? He's going to be interested in what's gone wrong, how it's gone wrong, how he can accommodate, how he can adjust, what he could do differently. And in some ways, our mistakes are there to teach us, as long as we're willing to observe them and act on them. The great difference in life are the things that we are committed to, that we really are interested in, that we lose ourselves in, that feels as if we're just flowing through them, and the things that we don't really want to do, don't really want to spend our time on, and we prefer to get out of. And there, those are where the mistakes are not going to help us at all.
Can you offer any ideas for making better mistakes or having a better result from the mistakes that we can't avoid making?
Yes, I can. There is a really interesting study done by someone called Dietrich Derner in running complex systems. He gave people the chance to be kings of a West African country. Now, admittedly, it existed only as a computer simulation, but had all the problems of trying to balance many different difficult forces that running society involves, in making certain people had enough to eat, that the hospitals were running, that the water supplies worked, and that wildlife was maintained, and so on. The people, by and large, made a complete disaster of the whole thing. They destroyed their countries in only about five generations. Massive overpopulation, complete environmental destruction. It was awful. But the people who were able to succeed were the people who were willing to take conditional steps, who were willing to say, I wonder what might happen, who were willing to say, perhaps, or maybe, or to a degree, or on the other hand. All the people who use those strong words like never, or always, or must, or have to, who spent their time saying, I must make a decision, rather than I must see what's going on, were the first to destroy things.
Michael Kaplan's new book is called Bozo Sapiens, Why to Err is Human. Michael, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Well, thank you, Chris. It's been lots of fun.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.